It's 8:08 in the morning. This is Upfront, and I'm Antonia Yuhas.
And I'm Brian Edwards Tekert. Just out of the Supreme Court, an injunction that had been in place, barring the most recent version of the Muslim travel ban from the Trump administration, has been reversed from the Supreme Court and remanded to a lower court until the full travel ban goes to trial. As a refresher, this was a ban impacting any citizen of Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, and in its latest incarnation, North Korea and Venezuela. It also extends to people who have visas for travel to the United States and people who already live here. Under the terms of the ban, if they left to visit their home countries, they would not be able to come back in under the terms of their visas without going through a rather extensive waiver process. First up for reaction, we are joined by Laura Kaswani. She is Executive Director of the Arab Resource Organizing Center. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So first off, what immediate impact is this Supreme Court decision going to have?
Well, it codifies what's been happening. Since December, the Muslim ban has, in fact, been in effect until the Supreme Court decision. So essentially, people have been separated from their families from all the countries you listed. And today's decision basically says this is now law and order indefinitely.
What about the preliminary injunction against it?
Well, it's not clear. We're still analyzing the decision as it stands in terms of what it means for us moving forward. We know that since December, it has been in effect, the Muslim ban 3.0, the third version that Trump tried to put through. And so today's decision basically says that 5-4 of the Supreme Court have decided in favor of the Muslim ban.
So, what next? Is the Trump administration able to keep a country-by-country ban in effect indefinitely?
I mean, it's been very clear that the Trump administration is able to do a lot. And so far as they are able to put into law and codify things like separation of families or even imprisoning families together, children and families together, or separating families from these countries that you listed, predominantly Muslim countries, it's clear to us that there's not going to be an end in sight unless there's more organizing on the ground here in this country and globally in opposition to the Trump administration. We're concerned because, we see people day in and day out who haven't been able to see their families for months now, years, from these countries. And so we are concerned that this is going to continue to happen and people here in North America are going to continue to be separated from their families. It's not clear what's going to take place in the coming days. I'm sure people are going to resist. We have a press conference and rally today at 10 a.m. at the steps of City Hall in San Francisco, and there's protests planned across the country. So obviously there's opposition to what's taking place in Washington, D.C., but at the very same time, the impact on these families, the impact of the Muslim ban, separation of families across the world is devastating. And these same families that are being separated are the same ones being impacted by war as well.
Laura Kaswani, we spoke to Zahra Ballou about this case yesterday, and she raised the concern that the difference between version 1.0 and the version in effect now was that version 1.0 created this immediate crisis. People stuck in airports because they were mid-flight when the ban went into effect overnight. It created a target for protests. It forced the national media to pay attention to it. And that the impacts of this latest ban are much less immediate for most Americans and much harder to rally against. What's your take as an organizer?
No, absolutely. It was much easier for people to understand really clearly the impact of the Muslim ban 1.0, as we call it now, in January, because people were stuck in detained in the airports. Right now, as we're talking, people have been separated from their families for months, since December, since the Muslim ban has been in effect, this recent version, but people don't understand the tangible impact of that, because it's not like we can go to the airport and try to free those families. People are literally being stopped in their home countries from even entering an airplane to come reunite with their families here in the United States. So it is quite different. But we, as an organizer, we always believe there are ways to disrupt the system. There are ways to really shift power and the conditions on the ground. And so what we have to do now is analyze that, not only for the Muslim ban, because we don't understand the Muslim ban in isolation of what's taking place at the border. We understand that what's taking place with the Muslim ban, what's taking place at the border, essentially are one in the same thing. So for more importantly, we have to figure out ways to target and disrupt the system that is having devastating impacts on people and immigrants and migrants, and not allowing them to basically put in practice their freedoms to move, their freedoms to stay, their freedoms to return, which is what we're all fighting for.
Can you give us a sense of what the impact is, has been thus far? How many people are we talking about? How many are being stopped from coming into the United States? And how many are stuck here separated from their families or separated from their families while here?
You know, we provide direct immigration services for many of the people from Libya, from Iran, from Syria, from Yemen, from Somalia, Chad. So we see the direct impact daily right here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Thousands of families are not able to reunite with people from those countries. In terms of actually getting a concrete number of people within those countries that aren't able to come in, that's hard to tell, because essentially all of the families of the thousands of people in the Bay Area from those countries are not able to connect, to reunite with their loved ones. So you can only imagine, given that if you know the Bay Area, you know there are many, many people from Iran, from Yemen, and from Syria, particularly in recent days. And so for us, we're seeing that many people are stranded in Djibouti, because people from reuniting with their families from Yemen were told to go to Djibouti because the American embassy in Yemen was closed. So they leave their families, they leave their country, they're fleeing to Djibouti in order to reunite with their families here in the United States, and they're literally staying in tents in what is basically refugee camps. And they're now told that they can't enter the United States. So people are stranded all over the third world, trying to connect with their families here, given the devastation on the ground in their home countries. It's not like people are choosing to leave these countries because they'd rather be in the United States. The conditions on the ground in these countries are directly implicated to the United States and their foreign policy. And so what we're seeing are folks that are dealing with war and devastation, starvation on a daily basis in places like Yemen and Syria, who are now told that they're told to go to a different country in order to get a visa, in order to reunite with their families here, and now told that they're not able to do that. So the impact is absolutely devastating to thousands of families here in the Bay Area and the community more broadly. All of us want to see people's abilities, put in action. And so it's quite sad to see that this is continuing to happen. It's been happening for months. It's hard to mobilize people around something that they can't see directly in front of them. However, if you're working with these communities, you know that this is impacting them on a daily basis.
And of course, this was a dramatic and overnight shift of tens of thousands of people being allowed in yearly, particularly from places like Yemen, by the Obama administration, and then suddenly the door shut down under the Trump administration. And can you talk about what, there must be an effect that people have seen the court cases come through early on, and there being early on seeming victories in the court cases, mm-hmm. and a sense in perhaps the general public that the legal system is already taking care of this or will taking care of this. Is that something that you're confronting and trying to organize around this?
Yeah, I mean, people often ask, what is it that we can do? Are the courts going to protect us? And we always remind folks time and time again that everything that happens is really a response to what's happening in the streets. So it's happening on the organizing and the grassroots level. Even when we saw last January, and when the courts ruled in favor of the people and against the Muslim ban, it was because we organized on the ground to disrupt the system, to actually challenge the Trump administration and the collaborators locally at the airports across the country. So we don't believe that anything is going to happen in the courts. In fact, the decision today and the decisions of the last several months have proven to us that it's not the courts that are going to protect the people. The courts are put in place to protect the government and the law. And right now we have an administration that is literally putting racist laws in order on a daily basis, and people that are tasked with enforcing those racist laws like ICE on a daily basis. So it's our task to really organize on the ground and put pressure on those who are making the decisions in order for them to rule in favor of the people, and to understand that we also have the power as people on the ground to disrupt that system. So now, it's, as we were saying earlier, it's a little more complicated. So I would really task everybody to do the research and to do to really look into where are the targets, the pressure points for this decision and all decisions that are taking place. How can we disrupt the system in a way that really protects and takes care of all those impacted by these racist laws?
We are speaking to Laura Kiswani, Executive Director of the Arab Resource Organizing Center. And if you're just joining us, the breaking news out of the Supreme Court is that the court has reversed and remanded a preliminary injunction against version 3.0 of the Trump administration's Muslim travel ban. This is a ban on people who are citizens of Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, and also North Korea and Venezuela, entering the United States, even if they have a visa, which means, in effect, people who are living here with green cards cannot leave the country to see family and know that they will be able to return. Now, the underlying ban will still be in front of a lower court, but in the course of reversing the preliminary injunction, the Supreme Court made a finding that there is not a likelihood that challenges to the ban will prevail on their merits, which is very heavy, signaling that the ultimate resolution, if it comes back to the Supreme Court, will be against immigrants' rights advocates. Laura Kiswani, I guess my question also goes the other direction. Now that the Trump administration has what looks like its first win in the courts on a travel ban, what would you expect to come next out of them? What kind of emboldening effect does it have?
Well, I mean, the Trump administration is going to continue to move in this direction of infringing on people's rights in this country, on attacking people of color and waging war on people of color and LGBTQ communities, on poor people. And so as we're even talking about the Muslim ban, we're also expecting other decisions that are going to have devastating, you know, impacts on communities of color and poor and working class people here in the United States. So really, it's not looking very bright in terms of what to expect from a white supremacist in power and in the White House. However, we know that whenever there is oppression and war and racism, there's also resistance. And so I like to think on the other end, what is it that we can do? What is it that we can do to actually resist these racist laws? It's time now to not only understand our work on the ground in relationship to how to shift and work within the system, it's time to understand our work on the ground starting today, starting in January, starting in November 2000, to actually understand what can we do to disrupt this system, to find the pressure points, to make sure that we are understanding these laws are actually racist and they're going to continue to become emboldened. Not only will the legal system be emboldened, but people on the ground and vigilante violence will be emboldened. We're seeing that on a daily basis. So really, we are tasked with figuring out how we can put a stop to this, how we can disrupt this system, and how we can find ways to organize and really resist these racist laws. The fact that the Trump administration was able to put this Muslim ban 3.0 forward, adding Venezuela and North Korea to an attempt to guise the fact that it's a Muslim ban. For us as AROC, we clearly said from the very beginning, adding North Korea and Venezuela only shows the imperialist also interest of this country, the fact that these same countries that they're targeting are countries they're literally trying to wage war against, and some countries that they are engaged in war against. And so all of us now need to understand that the Trump administration is at war with people across the world and right here in the United States. And we have to start to resist in a way that actually emboldens our abilities to make those direct connections and understand this as an anti-war movement, as a movement for people's freedoms, as a movement for people to not separate families. It was really wonderful to see across the country people taking action and against the separation of families. We understand the Muslim ban is also separating families, and we understand war as separating families. So as long as we are committed to keeping families together and people's freedoms to move, people's freedoms to stay and return, then we have to make those direct connections and work together to fight the Trump administration and to find those pressure points.
That is the organizer's eye view from Laura Kiswani. Stay with us. I want to bring into the conversation Elika Vafaye. She's an attorney with Asian Americans Advancing Justice and Asian Law Caucus, and get into some of the legal nuts and bolts of this decision. Elika, thanks for joining us on short notice.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, for people who are listening to the show right now, who are from one of the countries that is impacted by this travel ban, people who have citizenship in Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, or Venezuela, what are the immediate impacts? What are the immediate considerations?
Absolutely. So for individuals who are immediately impacted, as folks remember, the Supreme Court allowed the Muslim ban to go into full effect actually in December of 2017. So the ban has been in full effect. For individuals who have cases, many of our communities have actually been feeling the pain of the ban being in effect from December. There are plenty of free legal services for folks that they can seek, which are free. But for now, we need to see what will happen as the case is remanded and what kind of changes the administration will make based on this decision. But again, the ban has been in full effect from December.
What sort of changes do you think the Trump administration is going to make as a result of this decision?
It's difficult to tell at this point. Right now, the court has upheld the ban significantly. They did remand portions of this to the lower court, and courts have gotten major decisions wrong before, considering Dred Scott, considering the Korematsu case, etc. So there may very well still be litigation on this matter, but for now, the Supreme Court has upheld the ban.
And they've ruled there's not a likelihood of plaintiffs, the people suing to overturn the ban, prevailing on their merits. But the ban still gets its day in court, right?
Right. And so what the Supreme Court focused on was the preliminary injunction. The preliminary injunction was basically a mechanism that the lower courts used that essentially paused the ban from going into full effect. This was the preliminary injunction. The Supreme Court allowed the ban to go into full effect in December. And so they did remand the case to go back down for further consideration, although we do need to wait and see if there will, in fact, be further litigation or not. As of now, you know, again, we do believe that courts have, and we've seen that courts have gotten decisions wrong before. There certainly will be legal services for the community available, and we will continue to advocate outside of the court and inside of the court on this matter.
Can we talk about the kind of precedential importance of the court's reasoning here? They were reviewing several different issues, as I understand it. One was whether the president had racial animus or discriminatory intent when creating this travel ban. And they basically punted on that. They said, we're only going to look at the text of the ban itself. We're not going to try to look inside the mind of the president. Does that make it harder to bring discrimination arguments in similar cases in the future?
You know, I think we have to see on that point. I think that, you know, the court's decision to read the proclamation and the ban and the statements that were made as such were clear in their decision. And it's really important to, you know, look at the fact that, in fact, this decision does endorse bigoted ideals, right? And, you know, we need to look at the religious animus and the ethnic discrimination, and that runs really counter to exclusionary principles that we have. And we see that thread not only with the Muslim ban, but when we're looking at family separation and other immigration policies as well. It's important to keep that focus on what's happening across the country.
There was also an Establishment Clause argument, an argument that this violated the separation of church and state because the administration was making a decision based on categories of religion. And that also appears to have been soundly rejected by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, so again, the Supreme Court itself, in the majority decision, they do look at the likelihood of success of the Establishment Clause in the context of the preliminary injunction. There are, however, strong dissents that largely focus on the Establishment Clause, that largely focus on, you know, really how the ban is in fact keeping out particular religious communities, particular ethnic communities. And so it's important to look at the decision as a whole, not just the majority opinions as well, that focus on the preliminary injunction.
Any signs in the concurring opinions, particularly from Anthony Kennedy, that any of those justices might waver or change sides were this issue to come back to them?
You know, I think as of now, we really have to wait and see whether or not, you know, and how future litigation will move forward in order to ascertain that.
Okay. What's the fastest that this would be disposed of in the lower courts and potentially make it back up to the Supreme Court?
The litigation has moved fairly quickly because of the preliminary injunction piece, and so the courts will have to reconsider the remand. And in the meantime, I think that, you know, as Lada pointed out from AROC, our communities are very much focused on knowing our rights, our legal services, looking at different policy advocacy, you know, looking at what's coming down for the next 6 months, and how we can really continue to organize and continue to mobilize as we've been doing over the last year and a half now as well on this issue.
All right. Elika Vavai, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Elika Vafaye is an attorney with Asian Americans Advancing Justice and the Asian Law Caucus. And again, if you're just joining us, the breaking news out of the Supreme Court this morning is that in the case of Trump versus Hawaii, this is the case concerning Muslim travel ban version 3.0. The Supreme Court has reversed and remanded a preliminary injunction that had been issued against that travel ban. Now, the injunction didn't take effect. It was stayed pending appeal. The effect of this, however, is that for the foreseeable future, people who are nationals of Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, as well as North Korea and Venezuela, which were rolled into the latest version of that travel ban, will not be able to enter this country even if they hold visas without going through an extensive waiver process. That does not just impact people outside the United States trying to get in, but also people who live here on visas and green cards who would like to travel abroad, for instance, to see family or take a vacation. They cannot be assured that they will be able to get back into the country in those circumstances.